first thing, my jaw dropped when I read this article. And what is the SEC doing? My goodness.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial?
Adversarial.
It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome to the Adversarial Podcast with Jerry, Mario, and Sunil, three former CISOs talking everything cybersecurity. Thanks, guys. This is going to be a lot of fun. Mario, I believe you're in Europe right now. Is that about right?
Bonjour, Jerry and Sunil. Yes, I am.
All right. Sunil, you're not doing anything quite as exotic?
No. But I'll be in that part of the world soon enough.
Oh, awesome. Good for you. My biggest summer plans are Canada, but I'm looking forward to that. At least it'll be cool after the Atlanta summers. So let's jump right in, guys. Let's talk a little bit of cyber here and see if we can find something entertaining about it. As we're going to do every week, we're going to go through some of the most pressing headlines since the last episode and offer some of our candid commentary, and hopefully we'll balance each other out. All right. So from the if you're explaining your losing desk, I can't tell you how many times lately I've heard about what people quickly call the snowflake breach. Mm. And I digging into this whole story, and I think this is probably the biggest story of the last two or three weeks or so. That's what people call it. Mm-hmm. And so to the layperson or to a board director who's got a new interest in cybersecurity, and there's a lot of those lately, they're reading this headline as Snowflake had some kind of security incident. I dug into this. I couldn't resist. Mandiant in particular has really been on the front foot in reporting about this whole thing. I think they've been super clear here that there have been a pattern of Snowflake customers who have had, I hate to even use the word breach, who have had incidents where people abuse their Snowflake instances through stealing credentials from those customers to then extort the customers. But, and this rings true. It's been long enough now, and what Snowflake has come out and said is that, they haven't had a breach or something like that. What are your opinions on this? What have you heard about it? What do you think is happening? Like, what's the word on the street about this?
Yeah, so let's take a step back, and the fact that it's called the, quote, Snowflake breach implies something. And I'm going to use a word that Google first, proposed, which is this notion of shared fate. So Was it a Snowflake breach? And I think we're all saying no, it wasn't a Snowflake breach, and that Snowflake itself was not breached. But because we're calling it a Snowflake breach, because Snowflake is a part of it, clearly there's a shared fate aspect of this. Did 23andMe get breached? No. Credential stuffing, customers, got their information scraped. Is it a 23andMe breach? No. But there's a shared fate aspect of 23andMe that's been a part of this. And because of this notion of shared fate, or at least the premise of shared fate, we have all these investigations of 23andMe and presumably soon enough Snowflake around, did they do enough? Did they do enough to help ensure that these customers couldn't get breached? And that's really where it starts getting interesting, because sure, maybe they could have forced MFA on everyone, maybe. But there's a huge, huge business impact in doing so. So there's a balance that we have to strike here in saying, what can we do to help protect the customer? At the same time, that protection of the customer creates lots of friction for them, which irritates them to no end and causes us to lose business. But at the same time, we do have a shared fate model. It's not a shared, we use the word shared responsibility, but if we think about it in the notion of shared fate, now the business has to really rethink what can we do, because whether or not it's our customers getting breached or we're getting or we actually get breached, okay, or rather if it's because the customers are getting breached and we get labeled as a part of that, we are now suffering the same fate.
Well, as the former CISO of Snowflake, I stepped down back in December. I'm coming from the outside, so I'll put a disclaimer. I don't speak for Snowflake or for anybody who works at Snowflake, any executives. What I'm about to offer is just my opinion. Yes, I have some background because obviously I worked at the company for more than 9 years. But the information I'm talking about is just public information. And I would agree with Sunil. I would agree a lot with that. And there's a response, there's a shared responsibility that we have, a contractual agreement, maybe a social agreement between our customers and vendors. It is difficult to say, I'm gonna just turn MFA for everybody. Actually, it's really easy to say that. Let's just say that. I could easily say everybody's gonna use MFA. But there are some logistical challenges in that, folks. For example, a lot of our listeners probably have their own IDP, identity provider, right? An Okta or a Ping. And they probably also are leveraging MFA. And so, I don't know, maybe I'm missing something here, but how I, as a vendor, am I supposed to know whether you're using MFA for your IDP? And then I'm gonna force MFA for everybody. So think about it. So now you have to do MFA for your IDP, and then you have to do another MFA for your SaaS vendor.
Slack.
You forget about productivity. Let's just get out of the productivity stuff. Human beings will figure a way to circumvent that system. The harder you make it for folks to work on it, and I mean, our job, I would argue, is make security part of the business, but don't make it such a pain that they will try to circumvent the systems. And that's what I think we're doing by doing it. So it's not that easy. And by the way, what about non-human identities, application to application, right? How are you going to enforce MFA in that case?
On the shared fate model, and this reminds me of something that we always dealt with. So, at an exchange, not being consumer facing, it's a slightly different threat model. But there was this rash of events, and it probably is still to today, where people would do lookalike domain setup, right? And they would remember specific, like people in Australia were being called up by very sophisticated social engineering campaigns and saying, don't you want to trade, I don't remember what it was, but some options on something, maybe coal options. And people love that, right? There's this exotic aspect that there's a ton of money to be made if only you could get into options. So people are calling them and saying, oh yeah, we're on the whatever exchange, and it would be a name like a real exchange that we owned. And they set up a fake website, and they even had built, this is actually pretty impressive, they had, you want to go in, here's your portal account, here's your login, you now own X number of options on this coal contract, and they would market, and you'd see the price and the graphs and everything. It's pretty cool. And people would get and take it for $20,000, $40,000, that kind of thing, retirees. And then sooner or later, everybody would disappear and not answer the phone calls, and the website would go down. And then they would start actually looking up the real exchange and finding out the phone numbers, calling up, and that's where we'd get involved. Oh, wow. My God. But the conundrum, and I think this is where you get into the shared fate model and Snowflake's world a little bit, was I wanted altruistically to help these retirees. But I didn't want to overstep and take on culpability. I mean, I'm sorry. The last thing I want to say was sorry, because that implies that maybe we had some kind of hand in this. And so then we thought about, well, how do we divert resources towards monitoring for these lookalike domains, knowing that they're not really a threat to our P&L at all? They're a threat to the general public. And in our case, we came to a conclusion that we said, there's an amount we can do that is goodwill, if you will, and we're going to bat these down, and we're going to spend some of our own money because it is goodwill. And I think banks deal with the exact same thing, where most of the fraud, or in payments in general, is targeting the consumers and the individual users. And if people would follow all the fine print, there wouldn't be any loss at all. Yet banks are often eating these losses, right? They're not saying, oh, you're so stupid, how could you use single factor hanging up the phone? They're saying, all right, we're going to credit you back your $3,875. Please follow these guidelines. And there's a line item, in the financial statements about eating these losses, because they're trying to engender goodwill. Because people will say, how dare they hold me accountable for this? And they start ranting on social media and on and on. So there's a balancing act about this. And if you look at like a SOC 2 report, right, we've been on both sides of those a lot, there's a user control considerations part. Right, where you're saying, here's my 600 pages of absolutely inane, pointless, stupid controls, And over here, all this is particularly moot if you don't do these six things, like take advantage of whatever multi-factor it is that we provide to you. So it's important, but from a commercial standpoint, I think anyone that's worried about public perception would err on the side of kind of taking over as much of that user control consideration they can and trying to force people to not have something that could turn into a publicity mess like this.
Hmm. Yeah, I think this perspective of shared fate is what is also causing us to focus on, a lot of companies are focusing on these trust and safety initiatives to communicate to their customers, hey, we are, even though it's not really our obligation to do so, we are taking the extra step to demonstrate that, one, we understand there's a shared fate model here at play, whether we realize it or not, and two, even if it was because of your damn own fault, we are here to back you up in case things go south. And a lot of those trust and safety groups are the ones that I've seen do the takedowns of domains that lookalike domains and other things that pollute the ecosystem. One other quick comment is that this, it's not just in cybersecurity. You think about counterfeit products, right? So your luxury provider or any kind of manufacturer, you're going to aggressively try to take down these fake products just because it hurts your brand and there's a shared fate aspect of that.
Even if there's not a commercial implication, even if it doesn't rise to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, in security, we all know that term, the whole fog of war. You know, early on in some of these, security incidents, the early news may not be what's factual. And so I think we've all learned to be a little humble about, do I really know what's happening today? Maybe. But as we get more information, we realize that we're totally wrong initially. And so I think a lot of us CISOs have that humility to say, well, I may not know exactly what's happening, so I don't want to make things black and white. I was really disappointed with a lot of tech writers and not just bloggers, but actual legitimate news organizations making, sensationalizing this whole event. Basically saying, a lot of them was Snowflake got compromised. Their users and they have passwords and users of their clients, and that's and they practice poor practices by not enforcing MFA. And even when Mandiant's report came and clearly stated it was not Snowflake, it was not Snowflake being breached. These writers continued to tell the same original story. And I know they're trying to get clicks. I get it. I know what you're trying to do. But if you really think about it, you gotta think about the victims, and the victims are the customers. There really are. And you create all these FUD, unnecessary FUD, just because you wanna make a little bit more, you wanna get more clicks, you wanna get more popular. It's short-term, folks. And I can tell you all, to our listeners, look at those tech writers who said it was Snowflake's fault. Look what they said after the Mandiant report. If they continue to follow the same story they originally were selling you, I probably would encourage you to reconsider reading their articles.
Yeah. Hmm. That's sensationalism. Well,
One thing, let's actually go to first principles now as relates to what's caused this issue and what can we do about it. So as we all know, or as Mandiant and has been reported, a lot of it's originating from info stealers. Mm-hmm. And what I anticipate, what there's clearly now a whole new ecosystem of all this content that just needs to be mined to grab the interesting nuggets that can be then used to compromise a ton of different websites, right? And people said, hey, let's pick Snowflake, and whammo, there you go. And of course, part of the reason why these info stealers are there is because people are using their personal laptops to access corporate resources, and there's a whole story around that too. But let's just now go into the premise that we have this massive amount of content that's in the hands of attackers that basically people can pick and choose whenever they like, to find something interesting out of that and start compromising customer accounts. Okay, so with that in mind, what can we do about it? Might we consider, for example, every, it's like sort of like Patch Tuesday, okay? Every Tuesday, first Tuesday of a month, we just clear everyone's sessions, just reset everyone's sessions, okay? Or just after a month, we just reset everyone's sessions, or after a week, maybe, I don't know. But we shorten that time frame to make that the info stealers less useful and the content associated with it. I think, first of all, we should just do that now anyway. Like, if you own a SaaS application, if you're a SaaS provider, set a time frame when you're going to say, hey, every customer out there, I'm sorry, this is going to be a little bit painful, but we're just going to reset everyone's sessions and just invalidate everything, okay? And then going forward, we're going to invalidate it every 7 days, every 14 days, whatever. And you can set the time frame, but you have to set a time frame. It's not going to be infinite. And it's going to create some issues, but that's, we just get used to that.
Yeah, I there were a few technical tidbits that stood out to me for this one. For one, and this is interesting, it's not in any of the write-ups that I found so far, but always in Charles Carmichael's, the CTO of Mandiant, his shares, he's just awesome in general and has been again here. He's always one of the first ones to come out with this ultra-professional, polished, but super informative dives. And on this story, he, and only he, as far as I know, has drawn attention to browser sync, in particular Chrome browser sync. Yep. And I remember some engineer on my team years ago brought that up. I need to figure out who it was again and give them a high five. Because they said, we had blocked access to Gmail, right? And for good reason, it was a data leakage play. And we allowed access to accounts.google.com. So you could sign in because you might OAuth to your kid's school or your chess club or something. Well, yeah, who cares? Go for it. So we allowed you to OAuth to things. But as a result, people were maybe even inadvertently logging into Chrome and establishing a profile. When that happens, the bookmarks and the passwords, if you store stuff in Chrome, were getting synced. And it means when they then logged into the Chrome profile on their home computer with none of the enterprise protections, it could, and in this case, InfoStealer malware gets on there. Now, I don't think it was, I know it wasn't syncing session tokens, fortunately. So in this case, if this is part of the kill chain, it means it was syncing over bookmarks, which is important. You actually know the damn URL. And then the single factor credentials. And then to your point, Sunil, they're going through, hey, what did we get in the phishing net today? Oh, look, I got this thing called blah, 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 long ass string dot Snowflake, I have a feeling what this is. Let's try logging in. Oh, this is really interesting. And hilarity ensues, so to speak. So that was a very atomic-specific tactical thing that people should be thinking about and something you could do, right? You could push via policy down to the down to your endpoint so that syncing is busted. Or you can disable allowing auth to Google entirely if you want, but you can do it short of that. That's what we actually did. You could stop allowing people to sync out of that. But the other thing, I think this is important, this new world where everybody is 100% SaaS, whether or not they're BYOD, I think most companies are allowing those SaaS apps to be authenticated to and all of that if you have the right credentials from anything and from anywhere. And it feels good and everybody's pretty okay with it right now. But separately from whether or not you need a multi-factor, should it even be possible, even if you have all the right authenticators, to log in from a non-managed device? And it's complicated. To block that, it's hard, right? You need to basically say everything's going to go through an IDP, and you can't auth to the IDP unless you're on a managed device. And how do you do that? Not trivial at all. You can do enterprise browsers. That's why I'm a fan of those things now. You could do it with, I hate to throw vendors out here, but I don't have any dog in the hunt, but like Collide. I have customer who's looking at Collide right now to work with Okta and that, but that is not common. Everybody's not after that. You can get in your Salesforce instance, every listener, from your awful tainted device at your mother-in-law's house. What's up with that?
Yeah, I would, you know, look, I also invested in an enterprise browser, and I'm a believer in enterprise browsers, so my hands are not clean, folks, right? So, because I'm a believer in it, right?
For the same reason?
yeah. What we were talking about earlier, about these small businesses getting pumped, having, you know, I would argue, don't have a password as well. Kill your sessions. Have an enterprise browser. Use FIDO 2. Not MFA, folks. Not just MFA. You need to use MFA FIDO 2, okay? And by the way, you also need to look at the logs. You need to see who's accessing your environment. So all of that takes people, takes resources, takes tools. And, you know, I don't want to shame people who have the victims. I don't want to shame the victims. It's just the reality. Some of them don't have the budget, folks. Some of them don't have the skill sets to be doing this. This stuff is hard, okay? It's really hard. And so I don't want to shame anybody, and I'm not here to provide any guidelines or solutions. But sensationalism by tech writers is just wrong. And one more, I do have to go on one topic on this one is, okay. There were vendors, competitors of Snowflake that I noticed, or some vendors, basically saying, well, look what happened to that company. We're more secure. Let me tell you, folks, that is the wrong thing to do. And as a buyer, as a consumer of those companies, I don't want to do business with those companies,
run
okay?
to the hills.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. Piling on. Well, speaking of... So that I put you on the spot there, Mario, because that was your ex-employer. So let's go with the story about my ex-employer, too, to round it out, right? So this one... broke and I was ready to, you know, have the phone banks ringing off the hook and all kinds of stuff. And it hasn't really, which is really, it's interesting. And I don't know if it's just that people aren't interested or if there's just not a lot of hallmarks on this that people care about. But, you know, there's a lot of talk about Tim Brown at SolarWinds and the SEC going after him as being personally culpable and all that. And then this article drops about my former employer and the SEC having a $10 million fine, which... used to be a lot of money. It seems like it would be in the context of these other stories. But, you know, it's an agreement it's a settlement and not an agreement to any of the allegations and that kind of thing. But there's a $10 million fine associated with it. And there's a few articles that have been written on this. So, but I've not gotten pinged a lot on this, which is great. Is it a... the one thing I love about this is that as CISOs, we never get a story or the ability to talk about a win, right? Because a win is proving a negative. It was quiet. Hey, let me tell you about this thing that didn't happen. Who cares? And you're all prohibited from talking about anything that's sensitive too. So you can't even really celebrate any of these wins. But here's one. It's great because there's this massive long story out there that you can read that the SEC claimed and. While they are upset about and one thing that I think listeners should be aware of is that this has and the Wall Street Journal did a good job of this distinction. This is not the SEC public company rules, right? Which gives you 4 days to report and it's relatively new and all that. This is pre those rules, and this is a totally different regulatory regime called Regulation SCI that the SEC imposes on financial market infrastructure. A very small number of entities that are under Reg SCI compared to public companies. And in this case, they're saying notification was made in 4 days, and that was way too late because the Reg SCI has a much shorter clock. And it's a really nuanced. I encourage people to read it because if anyone's interested in where regulation is headed, this should be involved in there. What this is specifically saying is the company concluded that this was not a reportable event. We agreed with them, but we think they couldn't have known that within the 48-hour period. And therefore, they should have let us know and then wound it back when they ultimately... It's really splitting hairs in here.
Yeah.
But what I love about it is that... I think this is a good thing about it, is that it very clearly articulates the community, the committees, the senior management that was involved, that there was a group effort very early on, that people were aware of it, and that it wasn't a one-man show. And you know, this is... 3 years ago, so there was a good chance pre-Tim Brown or pre-Joe Sullivan and everything that he's been through that we before we had a chance to learn from all of that. So I'm glad that was the case and that it wasn't a unilateral decision about disclosure and all of that, because if so, I think I would be in the headlines and I would be getting a lot of phone calls and they would be very interested in me individually. Fortunately, there was a great paper trail here saying, look at everybody who was involved in, you know, minute one, minute 10, that kind of thing, not even at waiting for the four days. Hmm. So, you know, when you guys look into this, do you see any patterns or any questions about it? Or do you think that that there are things that people are going to learn about this or be curious about?
I think your insights on this is extremely interesting for a couple of reasons, because when I first read this article, I was like, here's hindsight bias in effect. saying, oh, we should have done this, then that. But when you're in the fog of war, it's not clear, right? But and you were in the fog of war, and it sounds like you took deliberate practices back then to document the fact that you were in a fog of war at this point in time. And we went back and forth, and they flipped on you, right? The SEC flipped on you and said, oh, well, we thought it was this, but now it's this. And now this sort of indecision is clear in the documentation. If you don't have that, then the hindsight bias kicks in and says, well, you should have known. And now you're screwed.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those ones that you never forget. It was really interesting. And the Avanti, right? Everybody had to deal with that. And what was really interesting, and this is public info, but it wasn't in all the SEC bits, is that right along that same timeline, Mandiant was coming out and telling in particular critical infrastructure, private pre-briefings, about these 0 days. And that people are actively exploiting them. And one of the bits about that is, and it's government only that's being exploited on this. So there's a lot of intelligence that you bake in too, that when you have an intelligence provider like that, where you say, okay, I have a footprint on here. What's the threat profile? What are they doing? Oh, we already know. As a matter of fact, they were telling us who it was and why they were in these systems and all of that. And so you weigh that in to say, like, okay, were they here by mistake? Are they here on purpose? What are they after? And you can also telegraph, like, if they follow the exact same TTPs they did at other victims, here's the next steps you want to look for. And so that's what you look for. And if you don't find those, then it starts building your case, like, okay, wow, I think we stopped them. I think we won here. To your point, all this stuff is going to get relitigated all the time. And so much, such a large part of global cyber regulation is around disclosures and just letting people know that we're all figuring out, right? Because you don't want to over-disclose either and kind of set the bar too high, and then people want to know about every CrowdStrike alert on your systems.
Well, I think the SEC, you know, I'm going to try to put myself in their shoes. They don't have the laws to really support, to really make it very clear in a cyberspace what is negligence, what's criminal, and what's not. Okay, this is not about insider trading. Maybe I'm making, because I'm not an expert in insider trading, but to me, trust me, I'm not. But the idea.
Not even an amateur.
Not even an amateur, not even interested. I don't look good in orange. So, I suspect that maybe in the insider trading world that the SEC is involved in, there's maybe a little bit more black and white. But I venture to say in cyber, it's a lot more complicated. And there's a lot of, again, fog of war. There's a lot of information coming in that today you think it's right, but it might be wrong when you get more information. I think the SEC is quickly learning. I hope that security, cybersecurity, is different than something that's black and white insider trading. I hope maybe they're learning something from. I'm trying to be optimistic here, Jerry.
I appreciate it. A few things baked into that. One is, and especially in a multinational with a lot of different regulators, people often will lose sight of the fact they think that every regulator is there to make sure you're secure, and that's it. And that's not the case at all. Every regulator has a very specific mandate and somebody they're protecting. And we all think of the SEC in their charge to protect shareholders, right? That's the whole point of the public listings process and whatnot. But they have other divisions that have different mandates. So like in this particular case, the reason why Reg SEI exists around financial market infrastructure, that's about preserving system integrity and fair and orderly markets for investors. And it's not about shareholder protection at all. It's more about the robustness of infrastructure, which is a very different charge. And that's why there are multiple regulations for different constituents. But I'll tell you, just to soapbox it a bit, because that's why we're on the show, right, is that we can speak more freely. Having dealt with a lot of multinational regulators, there are, especially when it comes to like critical infrastructure and financial market infrastructure, there are a lot of good efforts towards harmonization out there. Mm-hmm. We all think that there's not. But in particular, like there's these industry bodies, CPMI and IOSCO in Europe, who have really done a good job of having EU-level regulations, and then some of the particular continental European nations have adopted a lot of regulations that you see a lot of parallels. UK, Holland, EU proper, and they all have the same kind of outlines. They have their own takes, But it's basically intelligence informed. Figure out what you should be worried about and red team it. Test the hell out of it. Mm. Figure out where you stand, rinse and repeat. And I love that. And I remember getting them together with the CFTC in the United States, who then drafted their own regulations and really followed that model. And the CFTC system safeguards, which are the regs that they put in effect on financial market infrastructure, and that's a Commodity Futures Trading Commission, those follow that. They want to know about testing and red teaming, and they encourage all that great behavior. And I think a lot of the regulators, it's almost like all the regulators are starting to talk, and they're all getting together. But man, the SEC will not answer that phone. They're not interested. They do not want to be involved in any of this. And I'm not talking about the public company side. That's a different ball. But on the financial market infrastructure, oh, my God, are they over-indexed on system classifications? And you know, anybody who's tried to tackle, and Sunil, hell, you had a career in this, inventory, right, asset management. We can't even define the entities. Every day there's new things genomes that never existed in technology. And you don't even know where to put them in your asset inventory and all of that. And they're still stuck, 14 years ago inventory, and they want to see the database systems and which ones are Reg SEI systems and which aren't. And you never really get anywhere. So if there's anything I would say coming out of that, people need to open up and be willing to work with the, especially people that are overseas and in other jurisdictions, and really try to harmonize on this stuff. One of the first stories, and this one, I think it was my radar that it crossed first. I saw this really interesting article titled "Why Cyber Criminals Are Targeting Small Businesses," but what I thought was really interesting about this is that it was a win, right? Have you guys ever remember? And in particular, it said the total cost of this ransomware event was $25,000. Never seen such a small number in my life, and that they basically caught it in time, shut everything down, and it sounded pretty awesome. Like the security leader in this story really came out as a winner. Did you guys remember ever hearing good news?
Well, there's a couple of different ways I think you can slice this as potentially good news. So if we think about attackers going after things that are easier, things that are low-hanging fruit, well, smaller businesses are going to be weaker in that regard. But does that suggest, for example, that larger enterprises are getting harder to attack? Right. So is that a positive sign? Is that the silver lining? And so folks are looking at smaller businesses that don't have as good of a security posture and going after them. That said, yeah, these are smaller amounts with smaller businesses. You can only get so much from each one. But anyway, that's one potential way to read the narrative here as well.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this makes me think about the businesses of tomorrow aren't going to have laptops. Right. I mean, I think a lot of times people, especially if you worked in enterprise, you think, well, a big business has a LAN, they have internal routing, they might have a VPN into it, and they have laptops and desktops. And therefore, the old ransomware playbook is relevant, lateral movement and having the Guy Fawkes mask show up on the screens and everybody panics and all that. And they think that, and some people think that like new companies are just in Google Drive. They're using Salesforce and ServiceNow, and they're totally SaaS, and they're all BYOD temporarily, but when they get big, they're going to go back to that model. And I don't think that's true. I think you fast forward 10 years, and the startups of today are big, they're well-resourced, but, and this is anathema, I think there's going to be a lot more BYOD out there, less lands, people are remote, they're at home. So I'll be curious, A, if you think that's true or not. But separately, I think the ransomware, or more importantly, the extortion actors, are having to pivot from good old ransomware because there's nothing to ransom anymore, right? You take your father-in-law's business, so to speak, what are they going to ransom? So I think people are having to pivot to these to SaaS attacks and data extortion because of that. Not because they're better, but just because there's nothing left to ransom otherwise.
Yeah, I think this is also a general trend that we're seeing, even with the notion of a CIO. What do we need a CIO for? Because there's nothing, it's Ooh, all SaaS yeah. applications, right? And I've heard many cases where the CIO function actually ends up rolling under the security function, the CISO, right? So in that regard, it's that larger trend that we're seeing that then says, okay, what is it that we're actually needing to secure, and what are the attackers going after? And when it comes to anything that's on-premise, I just don't see, I think to your point, I don't see that movement coming back anymore. It's really moving away from the on-premise side to all these offerings that gives you business agility.
Yeah. Yeah. What, one of the things that caught me about the story too was that it basically, it started to fall into that kind of trope about patching. And I always like to say patching is overrated sometimes. And it was basically saying the reason they got ransomware is because they hadn't put on a patch. And I immediately thought, ooh, that sounds like a lie. That's not the way it really works, because this idea that upgrading your Chrome is what prevents ransomware, I just think is not accurate. So I dug in. I actually pinged the guy in the story, too, and he was really cool. He got back to me. But in the meantime, I had found a more deep article, and it was a patch on Microsoft Exchange, externally facing live. So that I agree. Okay.
Yeah. RC, you got to patch that.
Yeah, RC, that can lead to ransomware.
You know, when I read this story, I also agree with all of you. I thought 20,000 or 25,000 at the end of the cost associated with the ransomware was pretty small. I was like, wow, I was pretty shocked. But I did click on some of the research. There was a link on the article about the person who had done the research, and went into and reviewed it. And what I noticed is one thing that shocked me, and Jerry and Sunil, please correct me, but I thought the researcher said that half the businesses, the small businesses who had incurred these really impactful ransomware attacks, had gone out of business. Now, I don't know if that means, you know, could that be a restaurant? You know, a lot of the restaurant business, you know, they do go out of business. They tend to go out of business. But at least that's what I took it from that article. Mm. I also thought, and just another thought on this is, observation, I mean, that when you're starting your experience in the bad world, the hacker world, whatever you want to call it, that you may want to not go after the big whale, the big companies that may have a lot of data and a lot of money that may pay you for that data. You might want to get your hands dirty first by going to the small companies, because they may not have a lot of security bills. So to me, it was more like, yeah, they're learning their skills, they're honing their skills on the small companies.
So on a related note, this is a controversial topic. I've reached the tenuous conclusion that I'm in favor of banning ransom payments. And I think that would make this scourge go away overnight, or maybe in 3 months. Right? And I'll just throw out some of my thoughts on that and let you guys respond to it. Yeah, you know, I've heard it's a bit of a freedom topic, right? Companies should be able to control their own fate. At the same time, companies have been advised to be careful not to pay sanctioned entities. So there's this little, I'll call it cursory check the insurance company is supposedly doing to say, it doesn't look like North Korea that you're paying, so it's okay, we're paying them. I blend those, and in my mind, I say, why don't we sanction, we in this case being the Department of Treasury, OFAC, why don't we sanction as a John Doe ransomware gangs? So now the insurance says, well, I don't know if it's North Korea, but I know it's a ransomware gang because they just ransomed you. And so we're not allowed to pay them. And I think the first 3 months you'd have some companies that say, oh, I need to pay. I'm screwed here and the government is killing me. But that after that it would just dry up, right, if nobody's paying.
Yeah, it's an opportunity for us to point to somebody else and saying they're not letting me do that. And so, hey, ransomware gang, we need to renegotiate this because I just cannot, right? It's not like, it's not a choice as much. It's not my choice. It's the government that's doing that. But let's just to make this a little bit more real, let's play this out and see what it looks like. Someone has kidnapped your kids. Mm-hmm. And the government says, we are not going to pay. Our policy is not to pay the ransom. And so you are now having to hire negotiators, and the negotiators come out and say, sorry, you know, the U.S. government is not going to pay your ransom. Okay. Sorry.
Or not permit you to pay it.
Not permit you to pay, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to kill each one of your kids one by one until you do something here. And I'm sure you'll do something.
That's right.
I mean, you'll probably break the law.
This sounds like a prisoner's dilemma. I think somebody eventually... to say that you're not going to pay. So some company's going to pay.
Yeah, and people are going to break the law.
Yeah, they will pay. And what the ransomware folks will do is they will ensure that they return the data, everything's clean, and they'll say, look, it was done quickly. You know, nobody really got hurt. And then they'll make an example of those folks who are not willing to pay the money. So I think there's again, prisoner's dilemma
situation. It's a good perspective. But I think, and I'll try to you know, maintain Sunil's analogy, right? I think while it'll be a much worse conundrum for the companies who are ransomed under that regime, if you were under that scheme, it'll be much worse for them. But I think the whole apparatus of the professionalization of ransomware will fall apart, and it mm-hmm. will be a hundredth of the number of these things. And just like kidnapping, if it was illegal to pay, there'd be a lot less kidnapping.
Yes.
Not that it's as prevalent because of the lack of anonymity that we have with ransomware. But I think the net effect, and by the way, I mean, ransomware is a scourge, right? It's creating a whole industry here. I don't think it'd be at that level. Is there a kidnapping industry? Are we all talking about it nonstop? Are there chief kidnapping officers at every company?
Well, that's because the U.S. does have a policy that says we will not pay for, you know, we will not pay ransoms for kidnappings, right? Or for hijacking.
Or that it's illegal hijacking.
I don't know about the legality of it.
Oh, you're talking about we will not negotiate with terrorists.
Hijackers or whatever else it is. And so that higher level policy mm-hmm. then gives us plausible a story that says, hey, we can't. The government's not letting me do this. So if I do it, I know I'm breaking the law. And you bet some people are going to break the law because they have their business at stake. I think your point is, will it cause the industry itself to dry up? I think it will in some respects, or at least creates a negative disincentive to go that route. But you're still going to have individuals that pay out just because they have loved ones, you know, that they want to see, right?
If you could pick either way, or you're talking to your congressman and advocating for one way or the other, where would you go? Banning ransom payments or not?
I think that's the right policy, but we just have to recognize that when people violate that policy and break the law, that you need to show some compassion for the people who are going to break that law.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to work. I'm going to be contrarian on this, Jerry. I don't think it works. I think people are going to pay. They're going to break it.
Enough to keep the industry
absolutely.
Going.
Absolutely. Our government has done it as well. And they, you know, you're just getting a political point of view here between countries. You know, we negotiate with Russia. We send back some folks so we can get some of our own people back. Mm-hmm. And they'll keep doing it. So if our government, you know, Jerry, you're saying the government is going to put these rules on us. But if the government is unable to do it themselves or itself, then there goes our theory.
No, good points. All right. Now, next topic. So one of the things that since our last meeting, one of the things that has come up was with the United Health the massive ransomware attack there. Right. So we're back on topic already. But this congressional inquiry it turned into the typical lambasting in a hearing. And one of the things that came out of that was assailing the leadership of United Health for having a CISO that they felt was underqualified. And the citations around that really focused on their background in IT and in security, in digitization, and a lot of things that were technology related, but a lack of having a cyber specific post before that. You think that holds water?
So, okay, my view is, let's play the opposite aspect of it, which is they did install an experienced CISO. Does that make it now the CISO's fault? Okay, which I think is the wrong message there too. I think it was properly pointed, the concern or the responsibility does fall on the leadership, but I don't think it's for installing an inexperienced CISO. I think there's a lot of other aspects of the culture and what they prioritize and the business decisions that they make that led to things like this, not just simply saying, here's a CISO that's inexperienced.
When you read through either of you the resume or even just the summaries in these articles and you hear 14 years at Microsoft, including a general manager and chief data scientist for Azure and acting CEO for GE Digital, chief digital officer for GE Power, are you thinking, oh yeah, not cybery enough?
I first thing, my jaw dropped when I read this article. And what is the SEC doing? My goodness, please, I hope I don't get myself in trouble with the SEC, but what are you folks doing? I mean, it's not like they hire somebody who had, you know, was painting, you know, major arts, and that's all they've been doing for 20 years, and all of a sudden they put him a CISO. No, these are folks who have actually come up the ranks. They understand technology. They understand that space. And a lot of us, I would argue a lot of CISOs could probably learn from our CIOs and our technical folks and our engineers as well. So I cannot believe what I read that. I cannot believe what I was reading.
Yeah. Does this remind you, do you guys remember Equifax?
The musician.
Yeah. She was a music major, and people really jumped all over that, and that's the cause of that. I think there was a lot of issues even with that whole train of thought. But when I look at this, I mean, first of all, if somebody's been look, most CISOs aren't very good at being CISOs, sorry. So seeing CISO on there is not giving me a lot of comfort. I want to see risk manager, yeah. Right? Because being a CISO is about balancing. When I see P&L management, digital in general, I'm loving that lot more because you're closer to the business.
Right. And if you've been given the charter of saying, hey, balance the business risks with the cybersecurity risks, then you need somebody who understands the business risks, right? Mm-hmm. And this person clearly, I mean, at least to me, I got the sense that they understood business and business risks. And with the charter of now saying, okay, you need to now help us balance it out with security risks, there's a legitimate question of how much does this person know security and the security risks. But I think that's also one thing that we should recognize is that at the leadership level that we're talking about, the CISO here is much more of a business leader than it is just purely a security leader. And in my view, that's the perspective that I would come in to say, do we have the right business person to be in charge of accounting for security concerns?
I think the media always like to focus on these sensational topics or issues. If I remember the Equifax story, she played guitar or music, and she had a degree in music, but she had been a professional in technology and security for years. Mm-hmm. And folks, I hate to say this, in security, you don't want to do group thinking. If you're picking everybody from a particular security field, then the attackers kind of understand the mindset of those folks and how, you know, what they learned, how they were trained. You kind of want to have a diverse group of CISOs, in the industry.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think the problem I see with this particular approach that they're taking is they're trying to still fault somebody. And they're saying that, how can we fault the CISO because the CISO apparently doesn't have any experience? So can you really put them at fault? But the initial premise is wrong, which is, can you fault a person? And I will point back to the Challenger disaster, where a lot of folks are trying to find fault in a single person. But Richard Feynman, who was one on the review board, realized that there was more of a systematic issue. These failure points come out of the complex adaptive systems and emerges from these systems. And you can't necessarily just point at one person, which is why when we think about postmortems or blameless postmortems, we do that because we are trying to ensure we understand what's happening across the ecosystem of an organization. And if we don't see the fact that these sort of problems occur because the system as a whole, there's a problem with the system as a whole, then we'll start looking at individuals and trying to blame them. This is essentially that same process being repeated where you're saying, somebody's at fault, let's go figure out who that person is and shoot them.
Yeah. Boogeyman. Yeah. Well, and you know, what's interesting about the article is it's actually talking about Senator Wyden going after leadership for installing, tolerating, hiring the CISO, and that doesn't change anything. So I think I don't think it makes a lot of sense. Now, that said, if you're in charge of this witch hunt, if you're in charge of, okay, your people, in this case, it's a lot of the United States population, have been wronged and there's been a lot of impact. I do think that the buck has to stop with leadership, and you have to say, okay, You had its exposure here, and you either didn't realize it or didn't manage it well, and it manifested, and you've impacted society. So you need to do, you should have done better, and we want to hold something, some body at least, accountable. When I think about how I would do that, if I were tasked with, what would you have expected going back, United Health governance, to have been doing, I wouldn't be looking for patching metrics, right, or a better threat intelligence program or whatever it may be, or more cyber expertise on the board, which is what's going to keep on coming up with the drumbeat. What I would want to see is that on some board-level discussion that they talked about the different types of cyber threats with an idea of what's our mission, what do we need to care about. And if they dismissed a lot of them in that process, not dismissed, but concluded that those weren't hot, that's okay. That's mature to me to say, if they had said, let's look at the Russian black energy attacks on Ukraine infrastructure, should we worry about that? And they concluded, well, no, we're not critical infrastructure. We're not in wartime right now. That's not a priority. I'd give that a thumbs up. I do think in the middle of that type of assessment, they should have said, extortion is hot. It's in the healthcare sector all the time. It's right around us. That is our mission. And maybe they did. I don't even know. But I would want to see, that's the kind of thing I think happens at oversight. And then that should be what the task given to the CISO and that whole department should be. Study what ransomware looks like at orgs like ours and tell me if it would work. And maybe it happened and they said, yeah, it would work here. We're really susceptible. And maybe they had a whole roadmap of things and they just hadn't gotten far enough on it. Or maybe they were chasing the wrong things.
You know, I was just thinking about this whole, for the last year or 2 years, or last year, a lot of us CISOs have been worrying about what the SEC is going to do to us. Potentially, we're liable. We might even go to jail in some situations. So I think a lot of us are just basically saying, I don't want to be a CISO anymore. I'm the heck out of here, right? It's not worth it. Okay, and then at the same time, you're punishing companies for looking for other talent because all these CISOs are quitting on you. They don't want to have the responsibility of end up going to jail. And so where are you going to get this talent from? What's next? And then you're going to say, well, that CISO didn't have enough years of experience for them to be the leader. And it's just the wrong solution for this problem.
Yeah. And I think putting the... There's a lot of forces in effect that are creating this kind of tension. I think the point of what Congress is saying is, look, we're putting the blame on management. Yes, that's exactly where it should fall. And I think, Jerry, what you're saying is, well, okay, what should management do? If management is suppressing information, suppressing things that they should be made aware of, and because of their culture, because of whatever it is, key bits of information is being suppressed lower down in the organization, or they created a culture where sharing, being a messenger of bad news, is the, where the messenger is shot. Mm-hmm. The management is absolutely at fault, and they need to correct that. I think it doesn't really matter that this person had cybersecurity skills or not. The goal that they should have is to be able to bring that information to the right people. And if whoever is suppressing that is causing the decision makers at the right level to be ill informed about the right kind of decisions to make, then management, again, is at fault. It's not a single person. It's the whole process that needs to be accounted for. And that's, again, when I pointed out the Challenger disaster, that was exactly the same problem. And we're seeing this manifest over and over again in many organizations.
Yeah, I think so. Switching gears a little bit, and another thing that came up very recently, interesting story that you guys may have caught wind of about the venture community, right? And specifically to recap the story here, the idea is that there's this article, and you know it stands on its own. I haven't done all the research behind it, and I can't say that it's all perfectly accurate. So we'll see, and I'll say these are allegations and assertions and nothing more. But it's saying that CyberStarts, in particular, to call it out, that's what it says in there, has basically been paying off CISOs to bring their portfolio company products into those shops. And it spells that out. The way that it alleges that happened is that they have a CISO advisory board, which I'm not surprised at all. And a lot of venture groups do. I've participated in those, still do. But specifically, it was saying as this point system, and that people would earn equity into the fund by doing any of a number of things, ranging from taking sales calls to actually buying product. And, you know, when I talk with a few people about this over the last few days, I think everyone pretty quickly agrees that if you're a sitting CISO and you stand to benefit financially from a certain vendor, you know, from their uptake, and you don't disclose that at all, and you put your thumb on the scale to get that vendor in, and that's, you know, well over the line. That's a complete ethical violation. And with venture, you know, if you have any kind of remuneration from venture at all, then you start to wander towards that line. What if, you know, have either of you been ever seen anything that's anywhere close to this? And do you feel like this is a lot more likely to be overblown and sensational, or do we have a bad apple?
So there's a number of, without disclosing specifics, the story, the allegations that are being made, I actually think are true. And I should not just think, but without going through some specifics. And I should mention that I believe that there are some additional articles that are emerging that will have more of the kid gloves taken off. And so we'll see what those will say in the near future. But that said, I think the challenge is more of a universal one across. It's not just security, right? This is a issue across many businesses and many leaders. I remember the Netflix one a while back where there was kickbacks, and you know, the guy went to jail for that as well. The managing conflict of interest is a challenge when you are part of these ecosystems, and how you manage that is not specific to security. It's something that you all have to do. We all have to do, and do it with as much transparency as possible. When I was at Bank of America, I was not on any of these boards. It was a completely hands off, and wasn't involved in any sort of way that provided any kind of kickback. I did join them after I left Bank of America because I wasn't a sitting CISO. When I then became one, it almost served as a negative to be on their advisory board, because I steadfastly I did not even try to suggest that the companies that I might have some benefit from would be even considered, right? So it worked almost against them, which, you know, I was just trying to keep as far arm as possible. But that's me, and that's not everyone. And, you know, what's the right balance for folks? For me, even the perception of conflict of interest was a problem. But others will have other guardrails that they put in to make it clear that despite the fact that there's a perception of conflict of interest, it's being handled properly. So it's one's comfort level in that regard, I think, that drives one's decisions there as well.
Yeah. You know, I think as our listeners, I'm not trying to suggest, you know, this clean, sane, you know, cleaner than anybody else. But, you know, there's a saying that goes, pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered. You know, why risk your career for what? For 10,000, 100,000? Is that what we're talking about? To do this, for put yourself in that situation?
Oh, yeah.
I think the best thing to, and then how do you sleep at night with that? You know, the best thing to do is be transparent with your company. If you're advising some particular startup, just tell me. You know, a lot of us have had, you know, worked at companies where they do have rigorous programs, and you have to disclose that. You sign things like that as part of your agreement with those companies. You get trained on it, and even if you don't, just simple rule, you know, disclose it, just get away from it and give it to your team. I encourage you, if I like startup, I like working with startups. I think they are solving problems that big companies can't solve. So if there is a good startup out there, even if you're advising them, maybe bring in and encourage you to bring in their competitors and let your team and let other folks make that decision, right?
Yep.
But just don't take the money. It's not worth it. It's not worth it.
Yeah, I had a few experiences that were adjacentness, let's say. So one of them was, I was, and I think all of us have probably been on customer advisory boards of vendors, and it can go in either direction. Either you go there first, and or you are a vendor or are a customer first, and then you end up on the advisory board. And I remember being on the OpenDNS advisory board. You guys remember them? And then they got acquired by Cisco later. But before that, there was compensation on the table, which was. And I'd done a few of them before that, but I remember there were there was an equity options plan. Like, oh, you know, everybody on this advisory board, they treated us great. And OpenDNS, if any of you worked with them, it was some of the best founding team imaginable as far as like true, you know, intellectual sincerity. And they were they welcomed negative feedback, and they didn't push the product aggressively, but they did have options that were. Available or awarded, and I had to reject those. It was just, you know, when you work in financial services, it's usually not, oh, can I have this? Oh, they won't let me. It's more, I'm not even going to ask because I don't want to open that door and go down that hallway. I know what happens when you go down there. So you don't even bring it up, right? And that was the case. And so I, you know, politely declined. And then they ended up having a great exit and all that, which is interesting because it would have been worth something, but I'm really glad I didn't do it. You know, like to Mario's point, it definitely wasn't worth it. But I did later on towards the end of my career, I became an angel investor in some things that we were then evaluating at the company. And the way I set it up, I think it was a decent model, and I learned some things. So what I did was I went to my boss, who was the president of the company, and said, look, we're looking at this company here. I'm conflicted. I'm an angel investor in it. So I want to, you know, disclose that right now and designate one of my peers. And if it gets to the point where we're thinking about approving it, then I'm going to recuse myself and it's going to get redirected. And they might have to set us back a little bit because they have to learn more about it, but that'll be fine. But the interesting nuance, and I think I screwed this up the first time and then had to learn it, is I didn't disclose it downward to my team. I didn't tell my team, hey, I'm conflicted here, because when I tried that, I found that it backfired. You know, they're, oh, okay, well, thanks for telling us, but they were favoring the solution because Jerry was into it and he's an investor in it. And they weren't trying to be complicit or corrupt about it, but they felt bad turning it down, which is not what you want. I want them to be completely honest. So I didn't tell the team I was involved, let them have a fair shake at it. And if they liked it, and in some cases they did, suddenly my peer at the time was a COO, was brought in, and it was, hey, Mark, I know you don't know anything all about this. We've been looking at this product. I'm conflicted. It's going to route up to you. And you're the boss of all that, being aware of it. And that worked out pretty well, I felt. It was pretty clean. So I think there is a way to do it.
Yeah, you mentioned you didn't tell the team. I was actually had that same quandary. I was like, by telling the team, do I automatically start putting weight on the choices there? But you said that you thought that was a mistake. So
when I did tell the team on something early on, and okay, the way that I saw that behavior, I was like, oh, let me not do that anymore. That's not part of the model.
Okay, yeah, so I agree. I want to tell the people at my peers and at a different level, but the people who are making decisions, let them know at the appropriate time after they've already weighed in on the decisions, because yes, our vote matters to them. And if we've already made a vote by telling them, yes, we're invested or an advisor, then they will take that into account. And that's not what we want either.
Wow, I'm learning from both of you folks. I always, as I always do when I chat with you both, but I always felt that if I didn't come clean with my team and we ended up going with the company that I wanted, that I had invested in, that I felt, I don't know, I felt like I was hiding something from them. And to me, it was always, I always felt like just go make the decision on technology. And honestly, most of the time, I can't even recall the time when I had invested in a company before I introduced them to our companies. I actually did the other way around. Whatever company won, and my team felt strongly about it, I kind of ended up potentially investing in those
players. Yeah.
So I kind of did it a little bit different. So maybe my guys were playing me, now that I'm thinking about it.
Jerry, it's well, and then it comes up at renewal, though, right? Because now you signed off on renewal. Now you are conflicted.
Yeah.
I don't know what the right path is for. I like your path in terms of once you've made a decision and you have an opportunity to invest, and yeah, you can double down on that decision. I think that's a cleaner path. I think for me, it was more just to make sure that someone in the organization knew that I had a conflict of interest, but the people who were going to weigh in on the actual criteria and decisions and so on and so forth, give them as a pure model as possible, and then inform them at the appropriate time, hey, I just want to make sure you understand I have a conflict of interest here, but I've done nothing to influence the decision-making process at the lower levels.
Yeah. And I'll tell you a funny anecdote related to this. So at one point, I raised an SPV, a special purpose vehicle, but an investment into a startup. So it's the same type of thing. But instead of just doing angel investment, I think it ended up being 10 CISOs or people that were in that same area to all co-invest and go into whatever funding round it was of this startup. And I had these same conversations with everyone. So, yeah, maybe you're a customer of this. Maybe you might be a customer. We don't want to incentivize you to be a customer just based on this. And I told my story of, like, here's some tips. Here's things that I've done to avoid that, which is important too. I mean, it's much better to be ethical, because one purchase order, if that's what it takes to keep this company afloat, then you probably shouldn't be investing in it anyway. They should be getting more out of you than the PO, without a doubt. But as I fished this around and I was talking to different people, one of the folks that was really interested in investing said, and this is very common in a lot of companies, they said, if there's any potential conflict, I need to clear it. Oh, yeah, that's fair. That's great. If you don't want to do it, that's great. No, I'm willing to do it, but I want to run up the ladder and clear it. So they run it to clear, and they go to their CFO and say, hey, here's the terms here, and I'm thinking about investing. You know, is that approved or not? And the CFO said, I want to talk to him, and if I can get in the SPV, then I'll approve it.
Oh, my goodness. That's bad.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. How bad is that? So there's an example of everything as toxic as it could be.
That's a point where I'd be like, okay, let me start writing my resignation letter at that point.
Right? Yeah. We walked on the whole thing. So we unwrapped the whole thing. Didn't want to touch that.
I do want to say what Sunil said earlier, I think it has a lot of validity, is these young companies, they want you to be an advisor, and they don't realize that if you become a formal advisor to them, you really can't bring them into your own company. You can't. So it's a double-edged sword. As long as they understand that, then I'm all happy. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk to Sunil, I'll talk to Jerry, and say, hey, guys, I think this is a great product. You should look into it. I'm actually an advisor. I'm really excited about it. Might even invest in it. And if you guys ask me, well, are you buying it? Is your company buying it? I'm going to say, no, we haven't done that. It's conflict of interest. Yeah. But I like their technology. So Sunil's right. That tends to bring a little bit of a challenge because you can't bring them in.
Yeah. I would love it if these companies that I advise actually give me the product for free, because I'm like, no conflict of interest, and I actually get value, and hopefully, anyway, but that doesn't work that way. So.
And you're helping your company by participating in that case. You're saving them some money. Yeah, you might even argue. I know I have said to companies and funds before, it's kind of like a hybrid of Mario's approach and mine, but I have said the chances of us closing a deal now that if I become an advisor are significantly diminished. Yeah. It's just now going to work against you. It'll have to be in spite of the fact that we have a conflict and get it totally cleared. Hey, but it wasn't zero. It was still might do it, but you have to win on your merits. Don't expect me. Right. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be recused. So as a result, that's one less fan that you're going to have involved here.
Yeah. Well, one other thing that we should also think about is so far we've talked about the relationship between a company and the CISO. But the original article was talking about the relationship between the VC and the CISO. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that for just a quick moment. And I'm going to flag post this for a moment, because this is self-serving for the three of us. Okay, we are former CISOs who are now founders. And I would say, who better to guide a new startup than people like us, who both have been in the position but have no longer a conflict of interest and are now navigating a journey that they're about to go through, okay? So here's my statement to the VCs then. If you are truly saying, look, we are bringing in CISOs not because we think we can sell to your company, but because we want your experience and we want to know, we want your help in getting these companies through this whole process, then the kind of folks that the three of us are the right type of people, okay? And if the VCs are saying, no, you're not the right type of person because you're not a sitting CISO.
You don't have buying power.
You don't have buying power. Then what exactly are you saying here?
I totally agree. Yeah. And I'll tell you, and I think, you know, some VCs will listen to this and be interested in this too, right? They always want feedback about this kind of thing. And VCs will say, and I think it's true, that they get a ton of value out of just being a fly on the wall, right? Part of this whole CISO advisory thing is they just want to hear what are you concerned about, where are you falling flat, where do you think there's a need for solutions. And then a part of the Cyber Starts article has some justification for it in that regard. But in general, there's two levels of engagement with a CISO when it comes to venture, and it's pre and post deal. And the pre-deal stuff is, hey, we're thinking about data security posture management. Is that a real space or not? Or we're thinking about investing in one of these three companies. Have you worked with any of them? Or will you talk to these founders to whom we have not signed a term sheet and give us your candid feedback? And then the post deal, of course, is, hey, thanks for coming. Now I'm going to hand over the mic to this portfolio company so they can pitch you. And I think that the former is much cleaner. It's much more valuable. And but as CISOs in these advisory boards, we're in it a lot of times because we're interested in the investment ecosystem and we want to learn and we want to hear the good and the bad and the ugly. And you don't get that when you just get pushed product. But then also I feel like as an investor, if I find out that the only reason they were able to close, you know, the big deals of the quarter was because of the lead investor, you know, kind of force fed it to a few CISOs, then I don't feel like that's a sustainable model. So I don't really believe in the company.
Hmm. My time at YL Ventures when I was the CISO in residence there, I loved all the pre-investment meetings because that's where I learned so much through that process. And I think that's to going back to my comment a moment ago about like what is it that the VCs really want from us and what is it that they're expecting. If we see more of the pre-investment type of conversations, then I think that tells me that they are interested in the relationship for to help them make better investments, but also to help us learn and to be able to share our insights with the people who are about to build a product, and we can give them feedback on here's the real problem that we want you to solve. We learn in the process, they learn in the process, everyone benefits without any sort of conflict of interest to getting in the way.
Yeah.
Agreed.
All right,
guys. Well said, Jerry.
That might not be the end of that rant.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks,
guys. Yes, he's going to knock on our door next thing you know.
That's right,
anyway,
door,
yeah.
Well, thanks, guys. Hey, as always, it's great talking with you guys. I'm looking forward to the next episode already, and while we all have our fingers crossed hoping that there's nothing to talk about by then, unfortunately, we know otherwise.